His first Pulitzer came as part of a joint effort, a series. His second Pulitzer was in his own name, in his own right, and for his own effort. He is a nationally syndicated columnist. You may hear him weaving words for John McLaughlin or for Ted Koppel, for Leanne Hansen, for Jim Lehrer, or for Robin McNeil. He is Clarence Page, and he is our guest on this edition of Conversations. Clarence, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
You've been a journalist and columnist, journalist for over 25 years, if we count college internships and working while you're in school, almost 30. Was this a duck to water experience with you? Is this natural?
Time does fly when you're having fun, doesn't it?
You know? I hope so.
I got into journalism because first at a very early age for most people. I was 16 when I decided I wanted to be a newspaper columnist, and I tell the young folks, it only took me 20 years to become an overnight success, so be patient. But it was the early 60s. I was in high school in Middletown, Ohio, a little factory town, quiet place, and I was quite intrigued by all that was happening in the world at that time. There were sit-ins going on in the South. There was, the assassination of John Kennedy had just happened. There was the beginnings of what later became the Great Campus Protests, just beginning in Berkeley, California, an area you're familiar with, I know. Mm-hmm. And there were four mop-top young men called the Beatles who were playing on the Ed Sullivan Show, and nobody quite knew what to expect, but we knew that America wasn't going to be the same again. And I wanted to be a part of all that, and I saw journalism as being a way to do it. And I saw journalism also as being, especially because of the changes happening with the Civil Rights Revolution at the time, I saw how the media can be used as a force for good, something we sometimes forget. And that's really what motivated me originally. And I just got hooked. Besides that, Susan, my math and science grades were terrible. I knew I'd never be an astrophysicist, my original dream.
Mm-hmm. Was it hard as a black man, a young black man, moving into journalism, or did the field open doors in that time? It was 1969, 1970?
At that time, the door was just starting to crack. Young folks today, in the age of Oprah and Cosby and Ed Bradley, et cetera, Colin Powell, just don't know that when I was a kid, we didn't have any black role models on TV. Mal Good was hired by ABC about 1962. He was the first one on network TV. I think it was Frank Matthey at CBS was the second, and then Bob Teague at NBC in 64. Teague wrote a book about his adventures, and the title was Dear Nigger, because that's the way about half his mail was addressed to him.
Wow.
There was a tremendous negative backlash by white viewers to the very notion of blacks taking the same kind of jobs as whites in TV news. Newspapers were just as bad. But what was interesting was, my first time I applied for a job was a summer job in the summer of 65 at my local town newspaper, the Middletown Journal. And the editor told me they weren't hiring any kids that summer. And the very next day, a white girl who had worked for me on the high school newspaper staff was hired. She also happened to be the daughter of the executive editor, so I learned a lot of things there about the real world. And a number of the members of the staff, in fact, had protested. Several did on my behalf because they knew I'd already won an award then as a high school senior, a Southern Ohio High School Journalism Award. I was a well-known feature editor on the high school papers, and a fully integrated high school and all. And they didn't think it was very fair, but the editor told them that they could all find work elsewhere if they'd like. It was his newspaper. And I'm happy to say that 20 years later, that newspaper was the first one to pick up my column when I went into syndication under new management. But my father had told me way back then, don't get mad, just get smart, get your education, and the doors of opportunity will open up. Little did I know that in the late 1960s, we would have urban riots across the country, and the major media would be looking for reporters and photographers they could send into the ghetto without looking too conspicuous. And so suddenly things reversed. They were looking for black journalists, and there was no supply. We were not majoring in journalism at school because there weren't any opportunities. And so very few of us were interested in it. So they first went to the black press, the black newspapers, TV. Well, there was no black TV at the time, a little bit of black radio. And then they looked at the journalism schools. I was the only one in my class at Ohio University, the fifth largest journalism school in the country. Another friend of mine, Monroe Anderson, was the only black in his class at the Indiana U, which was which is one of the big journalism schools. So there was not a big supply. So overnight, I went from being a rejected commodity to a valued commodity.
I see. This is Clarence Page with us on Conversations. During the time we have together, I want to talk about as many of the issues you cover in your columns and in discussions in radio and in television mm-hmm. as possible. One interests me, just because I didn't expect this to come up, so mm-hmm. to you. You said in a relatively recent interview, when asked to characterize the civil rights struggle of the 90s, that you felt it was an economic struggle. And that stopped me. I didn't expect economy to come first. So given that we've got a lot of other subjects also to look at in that realm, why the economy first when we're talking about civil rights?
Well, these days, I think that, first of all, we have to change with the times. What in the 60s was a problem of two nations, one black, one white, separate and unequal, as the Kerner Commission said, is today much more complicated because a good two-thirds of black America, people like myself, have been fortunate enough to join America's middle class. It's one of the most remarkable miracles the world has seen. And it says a lot about America, says a lot about African Americans, that we've progressed so far so fast. We are in the age of Cosby and Oprah, et cetera. The American dream is not for whites only, you know. That's why I'm kind of happy to see the Cosby show able to, even if it is just a black version of Ozzie and Harriet, maybe that says something in the 80s and 90s. But at the same time, the lower 40% of black America is worse off now than it was 20 years ago, economically and certainly socially. It's more isolated. What Professor William Julius Wilson at the University of Chicago calls this concentration syndrome, where the black poor are concentrated in what we call ghettos. The white poor are not. They are dispersed out into working class and even middle class America, even though the white poor are of greater number. When we think about poor folks in America, we usually think black or Hispanic because their poverty happens to be concentrated. It results in a ghetto culture, gangs, drugs, decline in the marriage rate, a general hopelessness, which is the worst tragedy, I think. So that's why I say today's civil rights struggle, if you will, and I kind of hesitated because I don't call it a civil rights struggle. The civil rights struggle is part of a larger phenomena, for a larger piece of American history called the Black Liberation Movement. And we must look beyond just civil rights. We must look at the Black Liberation Movement, which began during slavery and continues today. The civil rights period, quote unquote, when you hear that term, they're talking about the 1954 Board of Education, Brown versus Board of Education decision to the 65 Voting Rights Act. That's only 11 years. What has happened since 65? Well, a lot of folks, especially white folks, think, well, the battle's over. You know, black folks have got the same opportunities as everybody else, so we don't need to worry about that now. The only people making a fuss are these demagogues. Well, it's not true. We're not out of the wilderness yet. We're not into the promised land yet. Black folks have to realize this, too, certainly. I use the comparison of South Africa. You know, if the South African government, the white government, had asked me, how can we give over political power to the black majority while still keeping economic power to ourselves? I would say, hey, come to Atlanta, come to Detroit, come to Newark, come to just about any American city where blacks are running City Hall and where there's a black majority, and you will see that whites are still running all of the main economic levers. The exceptions, of course, cities like Kansas City, or Seattle, or Fairbanks, where you've got black mayors but a white majority population. That's a different story. But when you've got a black majority city, you see that while they got the politics, they don't have the economics in control in any meaningful way. And that requires education in a free enterprise system.
That was my next question, is that then how do we get the economy into the hands of the people.
Absolutely. Well, it requires education. It also requires getting past psychological barriers. You know, we hold ourselves back in many ways. We blacks, whites, Hispanics, Native Americans, we hold ourselves back a lot of the time because we're not familiar with an integrated environment. We're not familiar with the unfamiliar. we're not accustomed to reaching out and understanding other cultures and going into a workplace where we're surrounded by people who are not like us, who didn't grow up in the same kind of household that we did. And I think that what we need to do is to concentrate more on things we have in common and less on what we don't have in common. But, of course, the key has to be education. The only problem with education is it's long-term. You don't get educated overnight. And people want quick solutions, especially in a political atmosphere. People want solutions that are going to be accomplished between elections. And if you're dealing with two-year election cycles for the House, House of Representatives, it's especially problematic.
So we have, in the Johnson era, wars on poverty, and we have economic zones that are differently defined per each election, right? Mm-hmm. Those kinds of quick-fix responses.
Yeah, and we've been through innumerable prescriptions over the years. I can just think back to from the days of urban renewal under Eisenhower to, you mentioned Johnson and the war on poverty, the CAP community action programs. We went to the various urban development programs like UDAG and CDBG and all these initials, you know, one after another. Today they're talking about enterprise zones and empowerment zones, as Bill Clinton calls them. And they are all dealing with some kind of economic reenfranchisement. But so often they nibble around the edges. They don't really, I mean, they talk about giving tax breaks to the inner city as an incentive for companies to move in. But we know that in America, especially the big cities of the lower 48, that we have seen those cities in decline over the second half of this century, the cities that we spent the first half building up, they've been in decline for more reasons than just taxes. And even if you lower the taxes, companies aren't going to rush back in if crime is still high and if literacy is still low. So we have to take a more holistic approach to saving our cities.
We're talking with Clarence Page on this edition of Conversations. He's a man from Dayton, Ohio, who is now in Washington, D.C. On the way, Ohio University granted him a B.S. in journalism in 1969. He worked for the Chicago Tribune as a reporter and assistant city editor between 1969 and 1980, very briefly with television, WBBM in Chicago. A TV station that put him as director of community affairs during the early 80s, and then news department reporter and a planning editor in the early to mid 80s. Then back to the Tribune, where he became a member of the editorial board, and after that 20-year struggle, a columnist. You see now Clarence Page on television on the McLaughlin Report, on McNeil Lehrer, hear him on also on Nightline, hear him on the radio every other week when Leanne Hansen sits down to talk with him and with Fred Barnes about the week's issues in review. This is Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes. We're talking with Clarence Page.
I'm a shameless self-promoter, in other words.
It works.
Absolutely.
Well, no. See, as soon as you say that, I have to argue. There's just such tremendous substance behind it.
Well, thank you very much.
See that? Here's this next question. I want to ask you about racism. We see it in that economic context. Mm-hmm. We see it in odd forms these days, it seems to me. We see it in skinheads, and then we see it in denial. But I don't know, even though we all kind of know it exists in between that range of I wouldn't do that and kill them, we don't talk about it much, or we don't see it much. Yeah. How do you, given that thought, take that word and look at it?
Well, you know, it's an interesting word to look at because to me, racism as a word is indicative of a big problem that has opened up since the mid-1960s in America. We don't speak the same language about race anymore. Prior to 65, we might not have agreed on everything, but at least we spoke the same language. When you said
across
a certain word,
line,
across racial
yeah,
lines, right. Exactly. Today, when you say a word like racism, white people tend to interpret racism tend to define it as pretty much the same as prejudice. The belief, and look up in the dictionary and you'll see it says the belief that one race is superior to another. Mm-hmm. So white people tend to define that as something personal. They say, well, I don't believe that, so therefore I'm not racist, and so I am pure, I'm innocent. Black folks tend to interpret racism in much broader terms. They view it as something that is not just individual, but it's institutional. It is historical. It's deeply embedded in American culture. There are practices, attitudes, customs, traditions, habits of mind that have gripped us all because we've been educated within a white patriarchal society, which gives us certain values. And imparts these to us so that we take them as received truths. And so as a result, you get such conflicts as, I remember Spike Lee was interviewed by Playboy magazine, and he mentioned that black people can't be racist. And this caused a big hubbub of critics saying, what does Spike Lee mean? He sounds like a black supremacist saying black people can't be racist. What he was saying was that black people don't have the power to oppress others in a white patriarchal society, so they can't be racist. He later went on to say, now black people can be prejudiced. And he said, yeah, anybody can be prejudiced, but they don't have the power to be racist. That was the distinction he was making, which is a very common distinction in the black community. And I've heard a lot of people make the same statement. I mean, I could cite you a bunch of different quotes from people as diverse as former Detroit Mayor Coleman Young, Louis Farrakhan, Dick Gregory, the president of Spelman College in Atlanta, a number of black folks from different walks of life who all will say the same thing, that blacks cannot be racist because racism implies power. And that is a little bit different. I know I've had white people, good friends, liberals, well-meaning people who will say, I don't like to be called racist, and they take great umbrage at that. And my response is, well, don't take it personal. It's bigger than both of us. Because a lot of times when you think somebody is saying you're racist, what they're saying is that something you have said is coming out of a racist white patriarchal value system. So it gets more complicated, and it gets problematic because on the one hand, white people are speaking the language of innocence, trying to declare themselves innocent of racism. Black people are speaking a language of innocence, too, trying to declare themselves innocent of responsibility for their own problems. They're saying, well, there's this huge monster called racism that's responsible for my problems. So the first thing that happens is dialogue breaks down because we're not talking the same language, and so we're more likely to argue than to really work together to talk about this thing called racism. So one of my missions in life is to try to clarify the language that we use. It's really gotten quite muddled.
Where should we be taking this discussion? How should we be taking it?
Well, I feel, as I said in my speech here in Fairbanks, that the last great hope for American society is what Martin Luther King was talking about, which is integration, but real integration, not just this one-sided thing called assimilation, in which everybody who's not a white patriarch or part of that structure just surrenders everything that they know as their identity and as their people and their background and what they have to offer to the great American mix. Instead of that, I like a real integration, which is ethnic sharing, which is different ethnic groups and different gender groups sharing with each other what they have to offer. I think we all have positive and negative values that we can bring to the table. What we have, Susan, is not either integration or assimilation in America today. We have desegregation. That's something quite different. That is a removal of legal barriers.
Yep.
And that's fine, but that's only a start. The removal of legal barriers. I mean, when I was a kid, there were laws that protected the right of the local amusement park not to admit black kids. So my parents couldn't take me to the local amusement park. There were laws that protected a swimming pool right across the street from my grade school, admitted whites only. I could not swim there. I had to go across town to swim. This is in the North. And of course, in the South, you had this rigid racial segregation, and you get quite a bit of that in the North, too, as far as the public schools went. We have done away with that. We have laws now that have desegregated society to remove those barriers. But now that the barriers are down, what next? We need to go beyond the law. We need to do more than just get into City Hall. We need to be able to reach out and really share.
And I think that if that it does lie at the crux, one of the problems is that somewhere in the back of your mind, racially speaking, in my mind, racially speaking, we are each thinking, he doesn't understand, she doesn't understand my experience.
Yes.
We are not truly in the same place.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how, as a nation, we get past that, plus all this baggage of history.
Well, you mentioned the word denial before, a common word used in support groups and in movement, you know, the 12-step movement.
Yeah.
And the 12-step movement says, you know, the first step is to recognize that you have a problem.
Yeah.
And that's our first step as far as racial denial, not just racial denial, but gender denial as well. I constantly hark back to this because this term of the white patriarchy, a term made famous by a black feminist named Bell Hooks, this applies very much to all the groups that are not part of that mainstream power structure. Deborah Tannen has written a couple of wonderful books on gender communications, and the title of one is "You Just Don't Understand."
Right.
Right?
Another one is "That's Not What I Meant."
That's not what I meant.
Sure.
You can say the same thing about race relations. I have another friend, Tom Kochman, who's a mutual friend with Deborah Tannen. He has written a book called "Black and White Styles in Conflict," which is about black and white communication differences. Mm-hmm. And he comes out of the same kind of bag that Deborah Tannen does. There's another woman I've recently heard about in the San Francisco Bay Area who writes about Asian versus Euro-Anglo, whatever, communications conflicts. I'm sitting here using my hands a lot, you know. In some cultures, people use their hands. Italians, black folks, I think we believe expressiveness is a mark of sincerity. In Asian culture, moving your hands is intimidating. So you just put your hands at your side when you talk. That's more likely to be the way you would converse in an Asian culture. And also classic WASP culture tries to be dispassionate, you know, and to remove passion from the voice because that shows that you are more in control.
Mm-hmm.
So these are just rudimentary differences of communication style that different cultures have. And instead of ignoring that, instead of acting like, oh, we're all the same, let's just look past color and culture and all, why treat color and culture like a blemish to be looked past? It's not a blemish. It's something that I think we all have that's very positive.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me about hyphenated Americans. Some people say,
yeah.
But we should just be Americans. What's your problem? Why do you have to be a special American? You know?
Yeah, what really gets me is I grew up in an integrated grade school. Every St. Patrick's Day, we'd all wear green. Everybody would wear green. And I didn't feel like I was being indoctrinated into somebody else's culture. What I was doing was celebrating diversity. When I moved to Chicago, all summer long, there was a parade every weekend for some ethnic group or another. We have St. Patrick's Day. We have Columbus Day, of course, and we also have Pulaski Day. It's a state holiday that honors a great Polish-American war hero. We have St. Stanislaus Day, which has been a holiday in Chicago, not a legal holiday, but a parade day in Chicago ever since the Germans first landed there, some of the original settlers. We have a wide variety of Scandinavians, Chinese, Japanese, Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, they've all got their own parades. I could go on with more, but these are all celebrations of diversity. Why is it only when black folks want to call themselves African Americans and suddenly people get uptight, you know, say, oh, you're trying to balkanize America.
What do you want?
What do you want? Well, they've always said that. What do you want? We want liberation. That's why I say, you know, we got to go past civil rights and talk about the black liberation movement, you know. But, you know, last night after I spoke here, I met a young woman who is a Yupik Eskimo, and she was in my audience, and we had a delightful conversation because I'm new to Alaska, and I don't know the Alaskan experience firsthand. But her story, she's a student here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and her mother is a Yupik woman who speaks no English and doesn't want to speak English,
mm-hmm.
Whereas this young lady said that she worked very hard to learn English, and she speaks it so fluently you'd never guess it was her second language. But she said she also feels torn because the Yupik culture is dying. it is like many other Native cultures in America. It's in danger of extinction, and that disturbs her a great deal. So there's this push-pull that she has as she wants to become part of mainstream America. At the same time, doesn't want to lose the Yupik culture. And here at the university, there is, I understand, a struggle going on over whether to have a themed dorm for Native peoples. And this is not the only university dealing with that. It's something happening across the country. And this is all part of being a hyphenated American. W.B. Du Bois wrote about this 100 years ago in The Souls of Black Folks. They talked about the double consciousness of being African and American. Du Bois was writing about the double consciousness of being American. I think Americans, all of us, Native Americans or more recent arrivals, whether we came over on a boat or the boat brought us, either way, we all feel a double consciousness because there is this mainstream American culture, but there's also the culture our families came from. And there is that pull we have that makes us all want to be a conscious, not just be conscious of our roots, but have respect for our roots. And therefore, you want others to have respect for your roots, too. Mm-hmm. And we, with all the talk about political correctness, et cetera, I think the real issue is civility. As Rodney King said, can we all get along? And part of getting along is to have respect for each other, to have enough respect to want to share each other's culture.
And to recognize that these differences are not necessarily disturbing things, but good things.
Absolutely.
You should not be undifferent from me. You should be different from me.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of disingenuousness going around with all this talk about the Balkanization of America. We are not the former Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
Never were, never will be. We are not even Canada with their conflicts over French and English. We are a very different and a unique country that's got some great examples to offer to the world on, as I mentioned before, the tremendous progress African Americans have made, not just since the Civil Rights era, but even after slavery. No other culture in world history has a people that came out of slavery and into functional literacy as fast as African Americans did. There's so much for us to offer that just gets buried.
We forget to celebrate, don't we?
We do.
This is Conversations on It. We're talking with columnist Clarence Page. I mentioned earlier his awards, his contribution to the Pulitzer Prize-winning 1972 series on vote fraud for the Chicago Tribune brought his first honor. The Edward Scott Beck Award for Foreign Reporting came for a series he did on South African politics, and that was in 1976. The Illinois United Press International awarded him its top award for his investigative reports on what was called the Black Tax in 1980. And for commentary, he earned the Pulitzer Prize in 1989.
That wonderful year.
That wonderful year. It must have been a wonderful year and a great surprise.
Yes, because my son was born about 2 weeks after the Pulitzer was awarded.
What a
period. I never thought the Pulitzer would be anticlimactic in my life, but it was.
Maybe that's good. You know?
Oh, yeah.
This is Clarence Page, our guest today on Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes. We were just talking. Oh, yes. I want to talk to you about spin on how we... We were talking about difference a second ago, and that's mm-hmm. what brought it up, and how sometimes labels, words, are used to kind of derail our consciousness. Now, this is an editorial comment that I'm making right
You're
out
allowed.
Front. Thank you
You're
very
the host.
Much.
You're allowed.
Thank you. When someone says welfare mother, David Dukes, or anyone else,
mm-hmm.
we get images in our mind. When someone says Lonnie Guinier, mm-hmm. the woman now has an image.
The quota queen.
Attached to her. She is the quota queen. When we have, let me think, job quotas. Mm-hmm. Jesse Helms won an election on the basis of the phrase job quotas.
That's right. Well, crime. Another one. Willie Horton. Mm-hmm.
Special rights rather than civil rights is coming out of a certain area of the religious fundamentalists.
Right.
Activist movement.
Yeah. And their attempts to roll back gay rights, especially.
My bias about this is that these words are charged in order to get us off a debate that can actually move us forward. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in your assessment and how you think, whether it's journalists or politicians or citizens, can get debates back on rail and forward mm-hmm. because spin is such a powerful force now in our society.
Yes, well, your editorializing has once again demonstrated your brilliance, Susan, because I think you're absolutely right. First of all, politicians should be true leaders. It should be true statesmen in an ideal world who can help lead us out of the wilderness. Instead, they're just as likely to lead us in if they can get more votes that way. And we have had, certainly since 1960, a considerable amount of backlash politics being practiced, especially by Republicans, because they saw in 1960, for the first time since in the modern era, most white Americans, well, first of all, in 1960, John Kennedy lost the South, the first time since the Civil War that a Democrat lost the South. A lot of Republicans saw a sign here of something which we later call white backlash. Mm-hmm. And in 64, Barry Goldwater only won the South with his ticket, which opposed the coming civil rights laws as some kind of an infringement on individual choice. This is why, by the way, black Americans, just to name one group, hear the double edge when people talk about individualism and talk about individual rights and choice, because throughout most black experience in America, those words meant the individual right and choice not to associate with you, a black person. So we have kind of a double-edged interpretation of that. But in 68, Richard Nixon pulled out all the stops, not just in the South, but with his Southern strategy, went into northern cities and won over white ethnics, opposing open housing and school busing, all these various desegregation efforts. And right up through the Willie Horton campaign and of course, Ronald Reagan as well with his talk of quotas and, in addition, welfare queens. That was a wonderful term. Take welfare queen and quotas and you get quota queen. This was the shibboleth used against Lonnie Guinier.
Plus that she was anti-democratic, too, that some of her writings, you know, they're not...
Not democratic.
Right.
And this depends on ignorance. The strategy depends on ignorance to work. It's a code word strategy. And Lonnie Guinier, actually, her writings, which I have read, she said nothing that wasn't in the Voting Rights Act of 65, but everybody hasn't read that act. She also talked about techniques for helping to empower minority voters that are already in use in various cities around the country. So how radical can that be? But most folks don't know that. And so the demagogues, like the Wall Street Journal's editorial page, who launched the attack against her, depend on most people not having that kind of knowledge. And so they turned her into a monster. They demonized her. Another thing that's important to remember that... this anti-democratic idea, the U.S. Senate is not democratic. The U.S. Senate allows for two senators for every state, regardless of how big or how small that state is. That is non-democratic, anti-democratic, so to speak. And yet, it's not a radical notion by any means. It's the way we govern this country. Again, we're getting back to the idea of denial, that a lot of people want to really stay ignorant and not really look and see what can we do to help remedy this, what Lonnie Guinier calls the tyranny of the majority, where the majority uses its power to diminish the ability of the minority to have a say. Now, some very creative new voting schemes are being used around the country and are being experimented with in order to help minorities have more of a voice. To name one, cumulative voting, which allows you to, say you're voting for a five-member city council, cumulative voting gives every voter the same number of votes as the number of people running for the office. So if you've got five offices to fill, you get five votes. You can use those five votes any way you wish. In other words, you can put all five of them on one candidate if you want to. So if you have a minority, say black voters account for only 20% of the population of the town. If they decide to put all their votes on one candidate to make sure that candidate gets elected, or two candidates, they can do that. And it also encourages coalition building, because you can get together with other groups and say, let's all throw our votes, accumulate our votes with these one or two or three candidates.
The other side of coalition building is railroading, though. What if our small Democratic group, anxious to see Harry elected, actually railroads him into office? I guess I'm actually asking you a perceptual mm-hmm. question here.
Well, this happens now, but it happens with what we call splitting tickets. Mm. A good example is the election we just had in 92 between George Bush, Bill Clinton, and Ross Perot. Bill Clinton won with, 37% of the vote? Because his opposition was split between Ross Perot and Very George true. Bush. Mm-hmm. Under some suggest cumulative voting ideas, under a plan that New York City used for many years to elect their city council, you would lop off the candidate who gets the lowest amount of votes. And let me back up a little bit. Each voter, this is called preference voting. It's a different kind of scheme. It's one that New York used, and for that matter, we elected our state General Assembly this way for many years in Illinois. Each voter not only votes for a candidate of first choice, but also lists a preference for other candidates. You know, you kind of rank them, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 as to what your preference is. So the one who gets the least amount of votes is eliminated, and all the votes that candidate got, the second choice selections those voters made will then go to the remaining candidates. So it's kind of complicated, but what it would mean is, in 1992, all of Ross Perot's voters, since he was number three, those voters would get their second choice. So those who like Bill Clinton for their second choice, Clinton would get those votes. Those like George Bush for their second choice, those votes would go to Bush. If we were to believe the polls, most Ross Perot voters were Republicans, mm-hmm. or they'd voted for Bush and Reagan, which would mean technically it's quite possible that George Bush could have won the 92 election with those second choice votes. This is the same scheme that conservatives are calling undemocratic. Mm-hmm. They're castigating Lonnie Guinier for something that could have elected George Bush. So I think they ought to take a second look at this before they go and say that she's some kind of anti-democratic radical.
Now, go back with us and look just at spin for a minute, and tell me how you think Americans can deal with this as a phenomenon.
You're talking about code words and all that.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned before, it thrives on ignorance.
Yeah.
The more people are educated and realize the game that's being run on them, the better off they will be. And this is a very old game. For years, slavery survived. By slave masters persuading poor whites that it was in their interest to keep the slavery institution alive, when in fact the slavery institution lowered the wages that poor whites could demand because it was the cheapest of labor. And this prevented poor whites from being able to ask for higher wages, so both were kept poor. Abraham Lincoln first became an abolitionist, it is said, according to some scholars. I come from the land of Lincoln, and my newspaper, I might add, was founded on two principles, free trade and abolition, in 1847, and sponsored Abraham Lincoln's candidacy for the White House. After those two favors to black folks, they never hired their first black reporter for 120 years. But anyway, Abe Lincoln was opposed to slavery because it lowered the wages of whites and had a negative impact on the wages of northern white workers as well as in the South. There were very practical reasons. So it's a very old game to divide and conquer people. I think it's in the interest of poor people and working people of all colors to work together on these issues. It's all in their interest.
And like the economy, the answer is really educate yourself and rise up.
Yeah, political education is very important, but those who have more money and more power are able to put their propaganda out more effectively. The healthcare issue offers an excellent example. The single payer plan, for example, has never gotten a very good hearing in America because it doesn't have a very wealthy constituency, whereas those who are opposed to, especially the insurance companies, have put lots of ads on the air, et cetera, to debunk the whole idea of government getting into health care at all, even though opinion polls show the vast majority of Americans do want the government to do something about this health insurance crisis that we've got. And you can say the same thing about racial issues. Racial issues are really a smokescreen for much deeper issues in our society. You know, as you know, I don't believe in race. I believe race is a social psychological construct that we've made up, because I know too many black people who are lighter than most white people I know, and I know white people who are dark as a lot of black people I know. I mean, these features tell us nothing. What race really is the psychosociological construct, and it is used by politicians in their interest when they feel it's time to use it in their interest. When it's in their interest for people to work together, then they help us all to work together.
Take a stab at American leadership today. Is it in a healthy state, an unhealthy state? As you say, it sounds like leaders are perfectly willing to use money, mm-hmm. race, the economy, code words, whatever they can to get to.
Talking about the state of American leadership, it's like talking about the state of American teenagers. Every generation thinks theirs is the worst that's ever happened.
Right,
I'm actually optimistic. I think Bill Clinton ended the era of white backlash, for one thing. It's not to say it couldn't happen again, but he very effectively defused it by, ironically enough, by using it against itself. Bill Clinton's focus groups during his campaign indicated that for swing voters, the white suburban swing voters who were crucial in this election, their reason for switching from George Bush to Bill Clinton tended to center on two things, welfare reform and Sister Souljah. Remember her?
Yes.
Sister Souljah helped Bill Clinton to distance himself from Jesse Jackson. The Republicans had tried to pin Jesse Jackson onto Clinton or onto Democrats in general. And they did it with Mondale and Dukakis, who didn't really know how to deal with Jackson because they didn't understand black folks well enough to be able to risk losing black votes by alienating Jackson. Bill Clinton, to his credit, has been working with black people virtually all of his life, certainly all of his political life, and was much more savvy on black voters, and therefore could, with greater confidence, distance himself from Jesse Jackson and certainly from the extremism represented by Sister Souljah.
Because as much as it might be characterized a racial issue, it was an issue of politics and propriety from his perspective.
Propriety.
Right?
The idea that one does not say that the rioters in South Central L.A. Didn't kill enough white folks.
Right.
That was just out of line, out of hand. It's the kind of hip-hop hype that a lot of hip-hop performers thrive on. And Bill Clinton, quite correctly, judged that most black Americans are as outraged by that as he is. Mm-hmm. And so he confidently distanced himself from that kind of extremism. It was a very important move because it really defused what the Republicans have been doing for years, which was pinning Democrats to this black extremism.
Right.
And same thing with welfare reform and the crime issue, as we've seen more recently. Bill Clinton has shown these are not racial issues, and that he could with confidence go into black churches and rail against welfare dependency and crime and get black audiences giving him a standing ovation.
He's gotten some flack for it, but it hasn't crippled him in any way. In fact, he still is standing quite strong in those areas.
The flack has come from predictable sources, mm-hmm. and I've given him flack. I think that some of it is pandering, and I'm going to say so. The three strikes you're out is pandering. Every bit of evidence shows that three strikes you're out isn't worth the money as far as the crime it reduces, which is none. But the public mood is such right now that they want revenge. They don't care if it works or not. They just want some revenge. And so Bill Clinton is playing to that public mood. He's a smart politician. It's the kind of pragmatism I'm very much accustomed to in Chicago politics. The idea that morality is fine, but if I can get things done is what counts. It's the Dan Rostenkowski syndrome.
Right. It worked for him for 35 years.
Yep. Got him reelected again with a landslide.
This is Conversations, and on Conversations today, our guest is columnist Clarence Page. If you're unfamiliar with Clarence Page, he is a columnist who, I was going to use the word attacks, but not in any kind of negative way. He is a columnist who takes on social and cultural issues and political issues and chews them for the benefit of his readership.
And can be found in the Anchorage Daily News. I put in a plug for that wonderful newspaper.
And can be found in how many newspapers nationwide?
Altogether about 130 at last count, from Maine to California and from Florida to Alaska.
Clarence Page on Conversations. You took on talking about chewing on folks when you feel they need to be chewed on. You took on Black and Latino leadership a couple of years ago for not dealing effectively enough with the AIDS crisis. Why? What's not being done and what needs to be done in Black and Latino communities?
I'm happy to say, by the way, that that is less true now than it was a couple of years ago. But for a long time, there was a strong sense of denial in the Black community about AIDS, because it was associated with a couple of things Black folks aren't too proud of. That was homosexuality and and not just homosexuality, but promiscuous homosexuality. Promiscuous sex, period, is not something the Black community is proud of. And drugs. That's what AIDS is associated with. And there's a strong, despite publicity to the contrary, Black folks are pretty conservative. polls show that rank-and-file Black Americans are considerably more conservative than the best-known Black leaders that we know of. And I felt and still do that that a considerable amount of education needs to go on in the Black community. I still rail in favor of the rights of gays and lesbians. There's a considerable backlash against gay and lesbian rights in the Black community. Well, and there should not be. It's a waste of our energies to go and turn against other minorities, especially when I know, having been Black all my life, that there's nothing new about homosexuals in the Black community. We had them in my neighborhood. In my church, it's not uncommon, and every Black person I've talked to who's argued with me about this, I've questioned them and found they had them in their neighborhood and their churches too. And yet there's always been this double consciousness, once again, the Black community, about gays and lesbians, that we will embrace them when they're our neighborhood friends or their family's a friend of our family. But in the generic sense, we condemn them. in other words, he's our sissy. He's all right. it's that kind of attitude. And it's not a consistent attitude. Same thing with drugs. It is, and Black folks aren't alone in this, but oppressed minorities like to believe that all their enemies come from outside. That's why there's a lot of publicity. Louis Farrakhan and various others talk about conspiracies, grand conspiracies by somebody else to create the AIDS virus and use it to invade our communities. Mm-hmm. The same people, perhaps, who are sending all these guns into our community. This is such malarkey, because nobody sends anything into an area that is a big commercial commodity. They are providing it, and there is a demand, and that demand will be met. There's a demand in the Black community for guns, including by law-abiding people who just want to protect themselves from the horrendous rise in homicides that we've suffered through for the last few decades. That demand is going to be met by somebody. They're going to come in and supply it. Same thing with crack cocaine. Crack cocaine was designed to be marketed to poor people. Where do you find your greatest concentrations of poor people? Among poor Blacks in the so-called ghetto, and among a lot of poor urban Latinos as well. So this is a grand conspiracy called free enterprise. And we got to work on the demand side here. We have to work to reduce the demand for drugs and for guns. And that is just as much an internal problem as external. We need help from outside, but we cannot depend on the Great White Father to come in and do this for us. Same thing as far as sexual promiscuity. I was just hearing a report on National Public Radio about how the AIDS rate is rising again in San Francisco, because young gays, in particular, young gay males, are being more careless. Quite simply, for years they had a great public education campaign that worked, but now young gay males are being more careless. They're getting drunk, they aren't taking precautions, and the virus is spreading again. Same problem in the Black community. Only in the Black community it's more heterosexual. There's a lot more cross-sexual transfer helped along by drugs in the Black community. So I'm happy to say that in the last couple of years, a number of people, Ben Chave is the NAACP. Joseph Lowery at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was a real pioneer on fighting AIDS in the Black community. The Urban League is making some effort. There are just a number of other activists across the country, Gay and Lesbian Task Force, et cetera, a number of people who are working on trying to improve Black community awareness. A lot of preachers are dropping the old taboos regarding language and all, and they're speaking candidly from the pulpit about what needs to be done to curb this plague.
And is this in your mind, what needs to be done about kind of whatever ails us in this nation? Is we have to take it on as ours? If we're Black preachers, we can't say, well, I don't talk about that.
Well, I think that, again, it's denial, you know, that we should not have... I do believe in candor of language, as you know. Not vulgar language, but just the opposite of, you know, the political... The PC that concerns me is not political correctness. It's the politeness conspiracy that we conspire to censor ourselves out of concern for being polite. Yeah. As a result... America has never been more candid in its talk about sex. We've got daytime talk shows now that talk about all manner of sexual behavior that used to be to be kept tucked away from the children in mixed company. But we don't have that same candor about race. We don't. Everybody's afraid of offending everybody else, and same thing with gender discussions. Part of it is the mistake of those. People who are the greatest advocates of equality because they have tried, in the interest of preserving equality, they have limited freedom. They're trying to put strictures on free speech. This is the whole PC controversy that we're talking about here. And I feel that the two go hand in hand. The history of the civil rights movement was such that without a free press in this country, where would the civil rights movements in the South have been if they had not been on television so that they could touch the consciousness of so many people, the conscience and the consciousness of so many people outside the South who could offer them support? So I'm a great believer in freedom of expression and free speech and open discussions to shed the light of truth.
We have to see it, whatever it is, hear it, whatever it is, so we can.
Yeah.
Nat Hentoff says if we don't talk about it, we drive it underground.
Oh, absolutely.
And it will emerge bloodier in the end.
Hentoff was a grand role model of mine. He's not black. I took my role models where I could find them. You know?
That's right.
And he's wonderful. And he called me not long ago because he saw a McNeil Lehrer essay I did on this very subject of freedom versus equality and said, Clarence, in 3 minutes, you just said what took me a whole book to try to say. And I said, Nat, coming from you, that means a lot to me, I tell you. It means a tremendous amount.
This is Conversations. Our guest today, Clarence Page. Critique the field for me. Where do you take the field of journalism to be? There's a lot of flack for... yellow journalism. I can't think of what all these programs are called, but all the programs.
Tabloid television. Yeah.
Sleaze television. Tabloid journalism, and the like. If we go back to our earlier discussion of spins and code words, that can feed in as well to this discussion of where the field is in the middle of the 1990s. What's your...
Yeah. I just led a panel discussion at the National Association of Broadcast, what was it? Broadcast Entertainment Television, whatever it is. I forget what it stands for now, but all the TV programmers, I'm sorry, NATB, National Association of Television Programming Executives, TV programmers from across the country, and we had a panel on tabloid TV and what has happened. It was very interesting because I was on the attack. You know, I was playing the Oprah Donahue role with my wireless microphone and the audience and this panel of people from CNN, from Fox TV, from a lot of different, you know, from local news, from network news, and talking about this very thing. I never heard such self-righteousness on the part of TV news executives, first of all, who were defending tabloid TV and what they like to call excitement, the rest of us call sensationalism.
Yes.
Even Ed Turner from CNN, not Ted Turner, but Ed Turner, their vice president in charge of news, that's done so many distinguished things at CNN. I asked him, Ed, you know, from Desert Storm on, you've done so much to show the real power of what TV can do, and you've set a new high watermark and high standard for broadcast journalism. Tell me, Ed, did we really need wall-to-wall coverage of the Bobbitt trial? And everybody laughed, and Ed kind of sat there, kind of cracked a smile, and he said, well, yes, we did. There was a great public demand out there for information on this. They wanted to really see this firsthand in a way that only TV can do it, and that's my answer, and I'm sticking to it.
Wow, and he ended it just
like that? I got the feeling from the way he ended his answer and from our later discussion that I know for a fact from my contacts at CNN that there was a lot of internal argument over whether to give the Bobbitt trial wall-to-wall coverage. I got the feeling that he was on the opposed side because at the same time, you remember, Bill Clinton was traveling across the old Soviet Union and signing a disarmament pact in the Ukraine. I mean,
sure.
And when they broke into the Bobbitt trial to cover Bill Clinton's signing, the switchboard lit up from viewers who wanted the Bobbitt trial. And yet, you know, there's always this conflict in journalism over shall we give people what they want or what they need. Always a conflict. Every day we make judgment calls on that. I make the call with my column insofar as selecting what I'm going to write about. That's the most important decision that a columnist makes. The second important is what you're going to say about what you're writing about.
Right.
The first thing is deciding what you're going to write about, what's your agenda. And these are not easy calls. It's never been easy in our business, and it's going to get more complicated now because of the increased amount of choices that viewers have. At the NATP panel, one Fox TV executive said that, you know, with an increasing number of channels, the viewer is becoming his or her own assignment editor. They're becoming their own news director. They're sitting there with their remote control, and then they're flipping channels and deciding what they want to see. And if you don't grab them as they're surfing past your channel, then you've lost them. They're going to go to somebody else. So you've got to put more fire and brimstone up there on the TV screen to grab their attention, just so you can get them into the tent, so to speak, the old TV expression, and sell them the snake oil. And that's getting more complicated now as viewers have more and more choices. So a choice is good. We want choices in our society. But as my mother always said, be careful what you ask for. You just might get it.
Always true.
And we've got it. And there's always a downside on a new development like this. You know, we do have more choices. We've got the C-SPAN, CNN. We have more opportunities to get educated by television. We also have more opportunities to be titillated by TV. Where does that put the old channels, the ones who had their virtual monopoly on our attention before? Well, their audience is shrinking. It's an irreversible process. Their audience is shrinking. They're competing for a shrinking pie. And that often means people will go for the lowest common denominator just out of sheer desperation. And that's why you get more and more of the Amy Fisher and Joey Buttafuoco, and stories like that. The soap operas of life begin to take over TV broadcasting programming. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really comes back to the viewers. The viewers have to show that they want more quality. And when the ratings for those shows go up, those of us who do the McNeil Air NewsHour and the other thinking people's programs, you know, we're competing for attention like everybody else.
Yeah. Is the future bright or dim for the field?
Oh, it's bright. I mean, it's uncertain, though. We're in a time of change. Increasing competition means more risk, and it means people who are... I think it's bright from a viewer's point of view, because, for those who are in the business, they might be getting ulcers, worried about how they got to keep their bottom line afloat and all that kind of thing, and maybe, you know, stations never die, they just change hands, you know. Networks never die, they just change ownership. But from the viewer's point of view, the viewers are increasingly getting more choices than they can do with. I mean, the very notion of 500 channels carrying what's currently inadequate for 7, you know. But we're gonna have, I mean, there's just outlandish figures get thrown around to how many channels we're going to have. We certainly are going to have more, not just regular TV channels, but these young kids coming along now, they're part of the computer age. And our newspaper now puts little code words, code phrases, after our news briefs, so that if you've got an online computer service, you can go to your computer and tap in these code numbers and get a longer version of this story. So we don't have to waste paper, so to speak, allowing a story more space that you may not care about. If you do care about it, you can go to your computer and call it up. Now, for old fogies like me, this is some new highfalutin stuff that I'm not used to yet, but the kids are eating it up. The young people are. They're part of a new era.
It's a long way from the Underwood, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Clarence Page, thank you very much. It's been a very interesting hour.
Delighted.
You can find Clarence Page in the print pages of the Chicago Tribune, or do you say 100 and...
Yeah, about 130 now.
About 130 newspapers nationwide.
The number either went up or down during our show. I don't know.
From Alaska to Florida and back again. Also, in magazines you may know, the New Republic, New York Newsday, Wall Street Journal, Washington Monthly, for whom he is a periodic contributor. Twice Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, columnist Clarence Page, our guest today on Conversations. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you join me again next week.